I'm Eric Morista.
This is Noam Shore.
And you're listening to The Last Team on Turf, a New England Revolution fan podcast.
So, Eric, the last few games have been interesting. Finally, the Revs are back after that long layoff with the League's Cup, which already feels like a meaningless interlude into the season. 4 weeks off. Yes, it was a nice coming out party for Messi and MLS, but for the Revs, injuries and time off, and they come back with three tough games. This last game, there was a TIFO that was held up by the fans, and just for anyone who's listening, a TIFO is a big kind of like banner or sign that's held up and it takes up the whole end of the stadium. When they raise it, it's painted, and it was a picture of four kids under a blanket, and the TIFO read, "The kids are all right." And at first, actually, I just thought it was about the Revs, given all the problems that they have, the injuries and Bruce Arena not being there. But it was, of course, about the four teenagers who are on the team. But it did make me ask, are the kids okay? Are the Revs okay? What do you think?
It's a real head scratcher. I think in any other season, I would say yes. They're in second place in the East. They should be able to lock up a playoff bid in the next couple of weeks. And they've done enough in the first several months of the season that they can afford, you know, we always talk about the usual Revs August swoon. They can afford to have that in September. But it doesn't feel like they're all right for a number of reasons. So the three games this past week were a 1-0 loss at Montreal, a 1-0 win home to Red Bull New York, and a 2-2 tie against Austin, where Austin scored a goal just as time expired. So the Revs actually dropped points in that game. And too many guys are getting hurt. The coach is nowhere to be seen with no explanation provided. Not by his choice, obviously. He's not AWOL, after all. And the team isn't clicking. It is going to have to find a new gear to make a deep playoff run here, because now the best player on the team has now been sold to Chelsea for potentially as much as $20 million, but I think at least $18 million.
I might quibble with that. I think I might take Carlos Hill as the best player on the team.
Okay, the most marketable player was sold. I agree with you, actually. Hill is the best player on the team and well worth the price of admission. But another team was willing to go out and pay big money to take Jordi Petrovic away, mostly because he's a lot younger.
Right, first-class goalie. There's certainly going to be a high-profile team in need of one of the best goalies in the world, probably.
Right, exactly. And you have Lionel Messi in the league now, so in an ordinary season, I'd say the Revs can probably just cruise through September and maybe get hot in the playoffs. Maybe Earl Edwards or this new goalie they're trying to sign, or Jacob Jackson will turn out to get hot at the right time. But that seems a much bigger ask now, with Messi's been in the league now for a month. And granted, most of these were cup games, but they haven't lost, and they had a couple of close calls, but they've looked unstoppable.
Right. Yeah, Miami is certainly the team to watch and immediately look championship caliber. And going back to the Revs, they're not just second place in the Eastern Conference, they're second place in the league. And I just came away from the last few games thinking they just don't seem like that at all. And of course, they are missing a number of starters to injuries. They've lost Petrovic to the Premier League and Chelsea. But they just haven't looked that strong. There are a few bright spots. We can get to those. But the Montreal game, first game back after that layoff, and they really looked miserable. They finished the game without a single shot on goal, two total shots. And I felt like they didn't have a heart out there. And I was wondering if the team had just given up, given all the controversy surrounding the organization at this point. But then they came back a little bit, right? A few days later, they had the Red Bulls game, and they managed to put a nice goal on the board relatively early on and held on, although it was a bit of a squeaker. And then this last weekend, a new signing, Tomas Cancelay, I believe, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, from Argentina, got on the board, I think his first or second start, got on the board with two goals, the two goals that the team scored, and they were very nicely taken goals. And you thought, wow, maybe this team is going to find its revised identity, given all the changes. But they continue to suffer with these second half lapses and not being able to hold the ball. And just a gut punch in front of 26,000 people, giving up a goal literally like right at the end of injury time. And it was extended injury time.
Right, and extended really for no reason.
I think it was Carlos Gil walking off the field very slowly. And Austin also made a sub, I believe, oddly, in injury time.
Ah, interesting. Okay. I had missed that, but it did go 40 or 50 seconds past.
Yeah, about a minute past. Apparently the goal was scored at 3 minutes and 50 seconds when there was 3 minutes of injury time, supposedly.
Right. Yeah, there's been a certain sharpness that was there earlier in the season that hasn't been there the last few games.
Right.
And you have to wonder if that's because the coach is suspended. And it's interesting that we're now in week 5 of the suspension. The suspension was at a time when the league wasn't playing because of the League's Cup. And so you have to wonder what is taking so long to bring the investigation to a close and give this team some clarity. If this was really a action by the coach that warranted just his suspension and not anybody else, then why continue to penalize the team with this uncertainty around the issue?
Yeah, it's really a strange, if not completely unprecedented, situation in professional sports. And I don't want to get into speculation about what might have happened or what's going on there, but to have someone, the head coach, someone the stature of Bruce Arena, away from the team with literally zero updates from anyone. There's not even any rumors that are going around of any credibility or any, you know, leaks or anything like that. It's just been zilch, zero, nothing since this was first announced. And I'm just not aware of any situation like that before. There's issues with the Celtics, but that came to a closure quickly, and there was some transparency around it. Here, there's been just nothing at all from anyone, and I don't know how to describe it or what to think about it. I think it was especially strange this last game when you looked at the sidelines against Austin and you had Richie Williams, an assistant coach for the Revolution, who's currently serving as the head coach. He used to play for Bruce Arena on DC United and I think the U.S. national team. And for Austin, you had Josh Wolf, who's the head coach, also played for Bruce Arena for the U.S. national team. It just gives you a sense on any given night the impact that Bruce Arena has had on the league and players and coaches, and there's many other players that have gone on to coach too. It just made it all the more bizarre to have this situation unfolding right now.
Speaking of soccer history, Noam, I've been doing a little summer reading. This book was referred to me by a friend. It's called Generation Zero. It's by someone named Hal Phillips. And basically covers the period from 1950 to 1990 when I think most of us think of what was happening as far as top flight soccer in the U.S. as really being a backwater, or something of a wasteland, and but honestly, not much known about it. And so this book does a really good job bringing to light some of the characters, some of the stories, some of the people involved, and really building up to that breakthrough in 1989 when the US qualified for Italia 90 and qualified for the World Cup, not as the book takes pains to mention, not qualifying for the first time since 1950, but qualifying for the first time. 1934, 38, and 50 were, invites. If you could, I think, afford the airfare, you could go to the tournament.
I wasn't
So
aware of
that,
that. Interesting. So there was
yeah,
no qualifying back then.
right, yeah. So that was sort of an interesting way to put it, that we had never actually qualified. And what was interesting, and I won't spoil too much of the book, but as you read about the attempts and evolution, and there were attempts to qualify in 82 and obviously 86 with Mexico as the host. It fell short. Canada was the CONCACAF qualifier in 86. And I want to say Costa Rica in 82. But just a whole generation of players, really multiple generations of players that came through, cycled through the World Cup qualifying process with varying degrees of near success. And it wasn't until conditions were just right. Or one kind of theory is that just slowly grinding forward, they eventually ground far enough forward and had sort of a golden generation that was able to break through.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. That could make sense. And I'm wondering if there were specific events, and I'll need to go read the book, but I'm wondering if there were specific events or periods of time where there were maybe more acceleration. Like I'm thinking of Pele as a parallel to Messi joining the league today. Pele joining the North American Soccer League, which brought a lot of fanfare, and he brought along other European players as well at the time. If
Yeah,
there
and
were events like that
I'll
which had a sort of a launching pad.
Yeah, certainly the NASL was the highest profile event during that time period. And what's interesting is that in some ways that specific example had sort of perverse effects of maybe setting the national team back a bit. And the book gets into it in a lot of detail, but basically every team had a quota for either Americans or players from North America in general. And so you had to have at least two North Americans on the field at any given time. But the league was so crowded with aging European and South American superstars that those Americans, while they were on the field, were kind of relegated to lower skill, less involved positions. It was, play hard, fit in, and don't screw up, as opposed to. So then, when it came time to play for the national team, guys really weren't getting as many reps in playmaking positions, in central positions, positions where they could have a greater impact on the game. Not to denigrate all the work those guys put in, but I think certainly the way the book tells the story, that had a little bit of a detrimental impact
Interesting.
on the
I've heard
national
similar
team.
arguments about the English Premier League and the top team in the world. It brings in so many international players that the English team players don't get as much of an opportunity and could hurt the team.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting plot line. I think it tends to play out across the sports world. The more global it is, the trickier it can be to have a national team that's really strong. I mean, you're seeing a little bit in basketball right now where the United States has had a much tougher time in some of the international competitions, the FIBA World Cup, which is going on now. I think you also see it in some ways easier for some of the smaller countries to break through and have successful runs. So I'm thinking back to like Greece winning the Euros a bunch of years ago now, but because they all play together in the domestic league, none of them were really great enough to break out, at least initially, until they won. And so they play together, they build that chemistry and camaraderie playing domestically and playing for the national team in a way that maybe you don't if you're England or some of these other teams where they have high profile players going everywhere. Of course, if you have Mbappe, you know, it doesn't matter. Or Messi, you know.
Right.
Guys can play anywhere.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, the potential negative effects of a high profile international base to NASL, and with Messi coming, and here he is bringing along Busquets and Alba. If that could end up having a similar impact here, I feel like there's more rules around the number of international slots on a roster, and there's more teams now as well, so there's a lot more opportunities for American players here anyway through MLS. But I feel like the arrival of Messi could have historical impact on the game here. It's already so popular at the youth level. But it feels like it's an entirely different game at this point with Messi and the celebrities in the stands and people going wild and just the excitement and quality of soccer that he's bringing to the game right now. It's unprecedented in MLS.
Well, it's amazing how quickly they were able to hit the ground running. I mean, I think of soccer as a sport where time with the team, you know, sometimes it takes a few games to gel or even a few months. And because he imported some teammates and they made some other upgrades to the roster, that may have accelerated that process. And because he's Messi, would probably be the other reason that
right.
that whole process has just been accelerated. But Miami still has a ways to go to climb up the standings. And, you know, he's talking about winning the league, which is, you can see why, because they haven't lost. But Miami has 25 points today. DC United's in the last playoff spot with 33. And just for context, the Revs are in second place with 47, and Cincinnati's leading the league with 57. So
Miami also has two games in hand. So right. Assuming they win those two, they would have another 6 points on that. So they're not that far away, assuming that they keep winning at their current rate, which I think is entirely possible. I used to think that the Revs had a chance. You know, that the Bruce Arena coming in and with some signings and more structure for the team, like they were trying to put a good team out there. But while the Revs are undefeated at home, and that's, I guess, impressive to some degree, Miami is undefeated since Messi arrived in all competitions.
In all competitions. And I think that is going to end up mattering a lot. You can definitely see that Miami car gaining in the Revs' rearview mirror.
Right, and I think for me, one of the biggest impacts is it makes me reframe where I think the Revs are going and what it means to be a fan of the Revolution and what our expectations really need to be. It's if the Revs were really trying to set a standard for a new Revolution, they have a new logo, had a new manager, a new training center, becoming a professional organization in the modern league, all of a sudden it's a whole new game that they need to chase to really be a professional quality team, I think, in the league. So it's sure they're going to put up a fight. They're certainly not at the bottom of the table, but it's difficult to see where the Revolution are going to go from here, at least for this year. And next year you start to get towards the end of the tenure for Carlos Heel, and it could be a rebuilding cycle coming up, but I don't want to speculate too much.
No, and we had talked about that earlier this season, that with Petrovic likely to go, now he's gone, but he was likely to go at some point. We hoped that they could keep him through the end of the season, but it didn't happen. Heel getting older. Some of the guys in that core getting a little older too, like Matt Polster, Tommy McNamara. And as we talked about with the TIFO earlier, there's plenty of younger guys ready to step up. the kids are all right. I actually wish they'd play those guys more.
Yeah, I agree that they're showing a lot of promise, and it would be nice to see them be playing more. It's interesting how Richie Williams has at least reverted towards a more senior roster lineup. The Montreal game did feature a few of the new players, and it didn't go as well as one might have hoped. But you know, they are young, and they need that time on the field. I think Noah Buck could also be an off-season transfer, already being called up to the U19 English national team, although he hasn't made a decision yet for the senior roster of either US or England. Some unknowns in the future.
Right. But encouragingly, you know, the Revs' new additions this year have played very well, whether it's the younger guys or someone like, you know, Thomas Chancalay coming in and scoring two goals right off the bat. And Ian Harkes has looked very good. What's it? Thomas Anthony Kay, is that his name?
Yes, Kay has looked pretty good too.
Kay has looked good. And even Earl Edwards has been serviceable so far. And, you know, I think he's someone who is a little bit of a journeyman who was brought in to back up Petrovic. But now he's going to have his chance to show what he can do.
Yeah, he had actually a solid game on Saturday. He had a great save at one point, and really wasn't at fault for either of the two shots that went in, I think. Well, going back to that TIFO one more time, I think we've had an interesting few games with different storylines. Will the Revs finally get it together and be able to play the second half of a game with the possession that they can do, at least in the first half? They have three away games coming up, so it'll be a pretty good test. And I'm sure there'll be some more news around the coaching staff at some point, any day now.
Absolutely. And go check out Generation Zero by Hal Phillips. Well worth your time if you're interested in U.S. soccer history.
I will do. Thanks for the recommendation. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Last Team on Turf, a New England Revolution fan podcast with Eric Warriston and Noam Shore. We hope you enjoyed the show and can't wait to hear from you. The show was hosted, produced, and edited by Eric Warriston and Noam Shore, and all opinions expressed are their own. Incidental music written, arranged, and performed by Eric Warriston. Rev's crowd clips appear courtesy of the New England Revolution. The Last Team on Turf is a production of Row 12 Media.